Good day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. As always, I'm really glad you've decided to join us. How do you talk about difficult things? Subjects like love, or death, or money, or sex? Do you have people or places that make you more comfortable when you want to talk about these things? And when you do, how does it build you up to be able to know that, hey, there's somebody who understands what I'm experiencing and where I'm coming from, what I'm feeling? I think these are tougher questions to answer right now, maybe more than ever before. We're 2 years into a pandemic that has killed more than 700,000 Americans and disrupted nearly every sector of our lives. And the places that so many of us enjoy and turn to for solace, schools, churches, bars, have become more restricted than ever before, and they're sometimes even scary places to go. Just to go and be. All of these changes are, of course, taking a real toll on our mental health. And depression and anxiety numbers are sky high by almost every measure. And that means people are having difficult conversations in smaller spaces between friends and loved ones, but they're doing it very often without the support that they need. They're doing it without the institutions that used to kind of set the stage for the ways in which we confront these subjects. And that lack of institutional support goes beyond just the pandemic. Topics like death and grief and romance and identity are increasingly left up to individuals to navigate alone without the kind of support that would make those conversations easier and more natural. That's where we want to begin the conversation today, talking about how we talk about really difficult subjects, whom we talk with about those subjects, where we do it, and how we do it. Journalist Anna Sale has been talking with people about these kind of difficult conversations for a really long time now. She hosts a really popular podcast called Death, Sex, and Money. And she recently published a book titled Let's Talk About Hard Things, where she explores emotionally weighty topics with a lot of different people. Anna Sale, it is really great to have you here with us on Detroit Today.
Oh, Stephen, thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah. So let's start with what is happening with the way we talk about tough things. Individuals and families are adopting more of a burden now, I think, because of the pandemic, but also because in general, they don't trust the institutions that used to frame, I think, the context for these conversations as much as they did in the past. So let's talk about what that change looks like. Why is it that we feel we're more on our own when it comes to plotting our stories of success and salvation than in the past?
Yeah, I really like the way that you framed it, because it's really a key sort of argument of my book, which is, you know, of course, hard things have always been a part of life, you know, death and grief, sex and love, figuring out who we are, figuring out how to survive and make money. Like, none of this is new. But as I was writing, you know, what I do think is new is this shift from being able to lean more on ritual and institutions as a place to go, to turn to help guide these kinds of conversations. And, you know, in a lot of ways that has changed in our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, think about, you know, church going trends, for example, have fallen a lot in the last 50 years in America, but also, like, think about money and banking. You know, like, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, you know, my parents had a set of people that they would go to at the bank in town. You would mm-hmm. sit at a desk and you would talk to a person face to face. all of my sort of figuring out how to deal with money in my 20s and 30s, I'm now in my early 40s, has been me and my laptop and like looking, you know, trying to figure out, oh, is this how one does it? You know, and so what I found is in my life, you know, when I became a parent, I needed to turn to fellow parents of young kids and say, oh my God, how do you pay for childcare? How are you doing this? Mm-hmm. And having these one-on-one conversations that felt really risky to start because they're not something that we are sort of taught how to do, to like cross that line into like, let's actually talk about, you know, the nuts and bolts of money, for example. And so that's the broader argument of my book, which is even if you don't want to have these conversations, if you consider them sort of like, I don't know, a little bit like oversharing or it's just not your style. In fact, like you have to. And when you do it with the people in your life, your neighbors, your friends, your family members, what you're doing is you're sort of fortifying and building back this sense of not being on your own, this sense of community that I do think is really important. So that's what can happen when you do lean into these conversations. You're building something relational.
Yeah. So the individualism, though, that you're talking about, you know, it leaves people feeling really lonely and anxious and overwhelmed and vulnerable. You know, I guess one of the questions is whether this distance from institutions is something that is kind of perpetrated by the institutions themselves and the change of those institutions, or is it that we have left those institutions? Is it us who are driving that, and then, of course, suffering the consequences and complaining about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really both and. You know, I think often in our politics, you hear either arguments about why we ought to return to these kind of traditional institutions as a place of solace, or you hear, listen to all these ways these institutions have been oppressive. I think both things are true. Like, we get something from being part of institutions, but also they are hierarchical, they can be exclusive, they can, you know, cover secrets, they can cause pain. I'm not necessarily making the argument that we need to return to what was with some nostalgic view. I'm just saying, like, let's acknowledge that how our society operates is different. And when more of us are moving on our own, moving around on our own, navigating these big life moments on our own, I think what you lose when you're not kind of part of larger institutions or larger groups, could be the word, or communities, you lose the ability to have sort of like pattern recognition. You know, like when you are in grief, it can feel like the most isolating, foreign, like, what is this? What is happening to me? Experience. And if you aren't surrounded by people who have said, yeah, that's what it was like when in the first 3 months after my husband died, or this is what it was like 3 years after I lost my child, like when you don't have that sense of like what you're experiencing is not just your own sense of isolation, it's something that is part of an experience, then you kind of it compounds the isolation. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Stigma and thought and shame and experiencing things on your own compounds the pain of what is already a hard thing to go through.
Yeah. So we need to have these conversations to be able to sort of unburden ourselves, I guess, of some of those feelings that you're talking about. And I know that a lot of us have a hard time even beginning to think about whom to have those conversations with, or how to have those conversations, or where. And in this book, I think you do a really wonderful job of talking about how many people have navigated that and found some success. So talk about the ways in which we're adapting, I guess, to this, and the ways in which some of us are figuring out how to get the things that we need out of being able to talk about these difficult subjects.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's different tactics that one can have if you're thinking, you know, I have this thing that I'm struggling with. Who do I talk to? How do I talk to this person? Is it going to make them uncomfortable that I'm having going through this hard thing? And how do I manage that? You know, so there are all those choices you have to make about who's the person that is the right person to confide in. And then there's the how, right? But I think one of the big things that I would start with is I think often conversations about hard things, whether it's grief, as I was just talking about, or like, you know, struggling with not having enough work or feeling like, you know, you're not where you need to be to feel financially stable. And that can be a really hard conversation to have. I think when you are someone who is talking to someone who's bringing a hard thing like that to you, the impulse is often like, okay, I'm going to go into solutions gear and I'm going to like help this person through this hard thing. And so often that takes the shape of something like saying, oh, well, how about like, let's workshop on your resume and let's look at these job listings, you know, really trying to get in and like solve the problem. When it's grief, it can look like things like saying, oh, this, you know, I know it's really hard, but this will pass. You're kind of having that impulse to sort of minimize the experience.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really argue in the book is a really important principle is to, as a listener, learn to sit with the discomfort of hearing somebody's difficulty.
Yeah.
And saying, oh, I'm so sorry. Because a conversation is not going to fix the loss of death. A conversation is not going to change the material reality of your friend who's struggling with money. But what it will do is it will give them an outlet to say, you know, and to feel heard. And that is meaningful. That is not, you're not fixing the problem, but that's doing something big.
Yeah. And I feel like sometimes right now, especially, that's hard for us because there's so much that is off kilter for so many of us, and our heads are full of the things that are going wrong around us and the things that don't make sense anymore. I mean, if you think of the things that we've all been through in the last 21 months, there's just so much that all of us are dealing with, and it becomes harder, I think, to even trying to relate to what is going on for someone else. I mean, I think there's an instinct to compare instantly and say, well, I know this person is really struggling and I hear what they're saying, but my goodness, you know, I lost 7 people in the pandemic. I can't do this right now, right? It's more difficult than it used to be.
I absolutely, and I think even if you haven't had that kind of profound loss, if you just have experienced a sense of like kind of losing a sense of the social landscape or the scaffolding of just like how mm-hmm. life works. Like mm-hmm. I had lunch with a friend outside yesterday that I hadn't seen in a couple of years, and I was on my way back home, and I was like, oh my God, I just really like, I seemed like an angst, like machine. And I had to like sit with that feeling of like, oh God, I feel a little like clumsy, and maybe like, you know, my picking up on social cues is a little off, and I needed to just like let it out. And I hope that's okay. But you know, like that's where we are right now. We're all kind of like, you know, just like when we were in middle school, figuring out how to relate to one another. Like we're all kind of in that moment of just like, how does this work?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And to try to extend a little grace to yourself. But I do try to kind of, my default is to try to be open about what's not all buttoned up. Because I think there aren't many of us whose lives are completely buttoned up right now. And so when you create those openings to just kind of say, here's what I'm having a hard time with. How about you?
Yeah.
Then you can have a real conversation.
Yeah. I'm talking with Anna Sale, who is the host of a really great podcast called Sex, Death, and Money. She's also the author of a new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things, where she explores really emotionally weighty topics with many different people and talks to them about how they discuss those things, where they discuss those things, with whom they discuss those things. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well. Call and tell us how you talk about really difficult things. How do you talk about really difficult things right now, as we go into the third calendar year of this awful pandemic and the unimaginable disruptions that it has brought with us to every part of our lives? Have you had a hard time finding places to share the feelings and the problems that you have with people whom you trust? And are you missing the institutions, the places that we used to be able to go to talk about some of these things? Also give us a call and let us know if you've had success recently being able to be vulnerable with someone on topics like death or love or money or identity. What's working for you in those conversations? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook or to Twitter and put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation that way. Anna, before we get our listeners into the conversation, I want to talk specifically about a part of your book. As I said, it's full of people having these hard conversations about these subjects. And in the chapter on death, you write about a woman named Megan who lost her husband to an accidental death after diving into a river. But I wanted you to talk about the texting system that Megan's friend developed to comfort her, but also to allow her space to be alone. I think that's a really important kind of balance to strike in all of this.
Oh, I just loved this story. I thought it was so loving. This woman, Megan Devine, she's a grief counselor, and she lost her partner in a sudden drowning accident. Her life just changed in an instant. And she described to me, you know, you have it when you have something like that happen in your life, you know, she described like your every, like 99% out of every unit of energy that you have goes toward convincing yourself of this reality, like every day. Just, she described this sort of exhaustion of just trying to integrate this new fact into her life. And she said, you know, what was so challenging when you're in that kind of deep grief is the people who love you and who desperately want to offer some comfort, they end up also taking energy, requiring energy to manage that intake of care. You know, people who will say things like, you know, let me know if I can do anything. And which is something I have said before. And Megan said to me, you know, let me just tell you, for someone in deep grief, the idea that they can, number one, like, think about what they need.
Right.
And then think about which of their friends is the person to satisfy that need, and then make that ask. Like, it's not going to happen. Like, it's much more loving to just sort of show up, drop the casserole dish off on the doorstep, that sort of thing. But she described this friend saying, like, I understand that you need the space while you're mourning. But I have to tell you, like, I worry about you when I don't hear from you. I want to know that you're okay. And so they developed this system where her friend would say, I'm thinking about you. If you are okay and you just need some space on your own, text me back an asterisk, you know, the little star. Mm-hmm. And so that was what they would do. Her friend could sort of shoot up a signal and say, I'm thinking about you. I love you. And I'm worrying about you. And Megan could just say star and say, you know, I'm not really in the mood to take a call. I'm doing okay. You don't need to worry about me or bang on my door. Like, but thank you. And they didn't have to have a conversation about it. I thought it was such a smart tool for communicating and expressing love between the two of them.
Yeah, that idea of tailoring, I guess, the way that you respond to somebody and thinking of specifically what they need as individuals, not just the general idea that, that people have needs, but what does this person need and how can I best accommodate that? I mean, that is, you know, I feel like that is the relationship building that you're talking about here in the, in this book. That is how we build the replacements, I guess, for these institutions that we've lost.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Anna Sale, author of Let's Talk About Hard Things. And we will also hear from you, Ken in Midtown, Adrian in Detroit. You're up first on the phones. If you want to join them, 313-577-1019 is the number. Call and tell us how you're talking about difficult subjects right now. You can also go to Facebook or to Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, I'm glad you've joined us. My guest this hour is Anna Sale. She is the host of the Death, Sex, and Money award-winning podcast on WNYC. She's also author of a new book called Let's Talk About Hard Things. She and I are talking right now about how we have discussions about difficult subjects, love or money or grief. And especially how we do it in a time when so much around us is disrupted by the pandemic and that all of our routines are disrupted and the spaces where we build the relationships, where we might talk about these things are also disrupted. We want to hear from you. What are you doing to be able to have hard conversations with your friends, with your family, in 2022? How are you finding places and people to be vulnerable and to be able to talk about the really complex emotions that I think so many of us are experiencing right now? Give us a call, 313-577-1019. On the phones, or you can go to social media and put comments there, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Let's start today on the phones with Ken in Midtown. Ken, welcome to the show.
Yes. Good morning.
Hey.
Good morning to your guest.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Go ahead, Ken. Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Yes. You know, about grief, number one, when someone is going through a death, you should never tell them, I know how you feel, because sometimes people get offended when you say that, because we know they don't understand what we mean when we say that. We say it out of love, mm-hmm. but that's the wrong thing to say. Also, you know, a grief counseling meeting, you know, at a church I used to belong to, I was in this grief program. We had a grief thing once a month, and you learn a lot by. But there's a lot of things you can do to, you know, to join grief ministries or get help. But and also another thing, never make financial decisions when you're going through grieving, because a lot of times people come to you trying to sell you this and have you sign in this, catch you off guard.
Yeah.
But
Ken,
there's ways to say you just tell them you love them and you're thinking about them, praying with them.
So, Ken, I'm curious, right now, given all of the things, the restrictions that we live with, some of the things you're talking about doing don't seem like they're entirely possible right now. Are you finding ways to continue to work in this space, helping people with grief, even though we're supposed to stay away from each other, for instance, and certainly not not be in close contact. What does that look like for you right now?
The couple family members that have passed away, one for due to this virus, then one for a long illness, a sister. So you call up on the family members and talk to them, you know, just, you don't have to always, I'm just saying, you just call every now and then to see how they're doing, you know, just to comfort them, let them know that you're thinking about them, still never leaving them alone or nothing like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the best way. But
Ken, I really appreciate the call and you sharing that experience. I mean, it sounds like you've got a pretty good grasp of how to manage around all of these things. Anna Sale, I wonder what your reaction is to Ken's call.
Well, I just love that Ken, you know, recommended the idea of picking up the phone and calling. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, for some of us, that's well-worn muscle memory. But for others of us, particularly young people, like, phone calls are out, you know. So I just think that sentiment of like, oh, this person popped into my head, I'm going to just give them a quick call. And it doesn't have to be a conversation about hard things. It can just be that like, huh, I was thinking about you, how you doing, you know, and then it might be, you might be reaching them in a moment when they need to talk, or they might not pick up the phone. But it's that reaching out, I think, that's really critical right now, as you say, Stephen, at a time when, you know, a lot of us are much more on our own than we are used to being.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Again, Ken, I really appreciate the call and you sharing that experience. Let's go next to Nikki in Royal Oak. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I have a question for the author about like dealing with grief. Sometimes when people are grieving, there's expectations based on family, your own family and the family that the person comes to, and kind of like grief comes in all different ways. So what would you say to people that kind of see grief and don't get the reaction or like the feeling that they think they should get when they are talking to them?
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, obviously the ways that we experience grief and the ways that we move through grief are very, you know, culturally specific and about, you know, what our families are like. But one thing that I heard a lot talking to people who had been in deep grief is feeling that sort of unspoken pressure of the person who is offering comfort to you needing to feel like you were saying you're doing a good job comforting me. yeah, and how much energy that takes. And so in what I have found in talking to my friends who have lost very close loved ones is like, you know, I try to be that friend where they can be a little bit messier. You know, they can have their moment of being really angry. They can have their moment of just being tired of feeling stuck with the heaviness of grief. You know, not be that person in their life where they have to show or demonstrate some kind of progress towards quote unquote healing. Because you know, no matter what kind of family you come from, you're going to have somebody in your life who's going to like, yeah, you know, need that affirmation. But you know, that's how I try to be in conversation with people about grief, is to sort of let it be messy and let it be unresolved.
Yeah. Nikki, is that what your experience with grief has been?
Yes, I'm a nurse, so I've seen a lot of different families and a lot of different ways of them grieving. So I was just, that was exactly what I needed to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. Nikki, I really appreciate the call and the really provocative question. Thank you.
And thanks for your work, Nikki, right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go next to Adrian in Detroit. Adrian.
Good morning.
Hey.
Good morning. This is a 2-hour show, is it not?
No, Adrian. It is 1 hour.
So if I may tell you, I love this conversation. Ken, who was absolutely awesome when he said, don't tell anyone you know how they feel, even if it's the same circumstances. Mm-hmm. And please, people, don't ask what happened to them, because the person that's grieving don't want to rehash this over and over again. And if I may mention, I lost my only son when he was 27, and you would have thought I had the plague, because anyone that had a son the same age, they would avoid me. And I don't know if they didn't want to deal with the pain that I was exhibiting. But I say, like your visitor said, just sit and listen. You don't have to say a word. If you know that person likes coffee, bring them a cup of coffee and you can just disappear. Or I always try to use humor because I love to see you smile. And I know sooner or later your sun will shine again. But it is never sit there and just offer information. It is the ear that they want to hear.
Wow. Wow. Adrian, first of all, I didn't know about your son. But I'm really sorry about that. And I'm sorry about the experience you had with people around you and the way they reacted. And I think that's not an uncommon reaction, because it does make us uncomfortable to talk about things that are unimaginable. I think any of us who have children, the biggest fear that we have is that we might lose one of them, and the proximity of that, that we might feel from seeing somebody else go through it, I think it scares us. And you know, that's not the right reaction, but I think it is a predictable one. Anna, I wonder what your reaction is to Adrian.
Yeah, Adrian, what you said about, you know, people sort of like falling away, it reminded me of what someone told me, which I just love, which is the opposite way to respond. She said, she was describing about having lost her grandfather and talking to a stranger about this, like sort of explaining why she was, you know, having a hard time. I just lost my grandfather. And she said this person turned to her and said, oh, what was his name? And she got to say his name, and she got to talk about her grandfather, and she realized like what an uncommon interaction that was as she was in grief, to get to say, oh, let me tell you a little bit about him, that people just don't ask. So I wondered if you wanted to tell us the name of your son.
Yeah, Adrian.
If I wanted to do what again?
Tell us the name of your son. What was your son's name?
Benny Frank Brown.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for sharing. Yeah. Thanks for telling us about Benny.
And thank you very much. This conversation that you're having is very hard. It's even tearful to mention his name, but still the conversation must be had to let people know. Please don't avoid those people in grief. Just find out what they need just by listening, and they'll let you know exactly what they need. If they need nothing from you at that time, that's good too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thank you very much.
Adrian, thank you for calling and for sharing that with us and the listeners. Okay, when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Anna Sale, author of Let's Talk About Hard Things, about how we talk about hard things. We want to continue to hear from you on the phones and social media. 313-577-1019 is always the number. Call and tell us how you are managing difficult conversations right now. Tell us if you found a way to have difficult conversations that maybe you didn't know about before the pandemic. There are lots of us trying to adapt to the new restrictions and rules. You can also go to social media and leave comments there, and we can include you in the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences.
The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for joining. My guest this hour is Anna Sale, who is a host of the Death, Sex, and Money award-winning podcast on WNYC in New York. She's also author of a book called Let's Talk About Hard Things. We're talking right now about how we have difficult discussions in a time where everything looks different than it did before, and certainly the ways in which we interact with one another are fundamentally different than the way they were before the pandemic. How are you finding ways to find solace in difficult conversations, conversations you have to have for your own emotional well-being? They're more difficult now, I think, because of the disruptions. You can always give us a call, 313-577-1019. Or go to social media and leave comments there, and we can include you in the discussion that way. Anna, before I get back to our callers, I do want to talk about another part of your book, which is about money. And I think money is one of the more interesting things that is difficult to talk about. And there was a part of your book that I just wanted to read from that I thought was really insightful about our difficulties with money. You say that the risk that stalls most money conversations is our fear of how we'll look compared to the person that we're talking to. We do a lot of sleight of hand to obscure how we're doing financially. That's true from our most intimate relationships to our national politics. We live in an era when tech billionaires wear jeans and sneakers, struggling people carry designer purses, and doctors and lawyers are drowning in student loan debt. I thought that was a really, really incisive way to talk about both that personal struggle with money and then the cultural problem that I think we have with money. You also, in another part of the book, talk about the historical problems that we have with money and what it means in this country. So how do we talk about all of these things? How are we supposed to talk about money?
Well, I think one really important part of that chapter that I really wanted to stress is that talking about money is there's lots of different conversations you're having at the same time. And it can get confusing when you don't sort of like think about, what are we talking about here? For example, you know, that passage you just read is so much around money and status anxiety and all these cultural ideas we have around sort of appearing like we are part of the great middle class in America, that that's the honorable place to be. And you see polling where, you know, there's much more of an instinct to identify as somebody who is in the middle class. Then when you look at income distribution, you know, the middle class is getting smaller, but people are still wanting to claim to be in the middle class in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you have that instinct to appear like you are like everybody else, what ends up happening is you're not seeing clearly what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the macro level of why I think talking more concretely about money is important, so we can understand who our economy is working for and who it very much is not working for. But I also think, you know, when you talk about money, I write about different partners and marriages in the book in that chapter, where, you know, we have a lot of different cultural values around money and, mm-hmm. and how one ought to take care of, for example, members of their family of origin. For example, you know, I grew up in a family where independence was sort of the prize and achievement and showing that you could stand on your own two feet. That's very different from other families, mm-hmm. where the idea of showing up for each other well into adulthood and in extended families, like, you know, that's a very different way of thinking about money. And when you don't have the language to say, oh, in my family, we share. In my family, we do this to take care of each other. And then I can say, oh, huh. Like, my family is different than that. Mm-hmm. Is that a set of beliefs and values I want to hang on to, or do I want to sort of loosen it up? But when you don't sort of have the language to describe the money values that you grew up with to interrogate them, you can have all kinds of misunderstandings when you're trying to make a decision, for example, in a marriage about, like, you know, what size mortgage you feel comfortable affording.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Really important things to these, again, to these relationships that you need to have intact in order to have these conversations about not just money, but all the other sensitive subjects. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go back to them with Barbara in Northville. Barbara, what's on your mind?
Good morning. This is a fantastic topic. I would like to extend my heartfelt condolences to your previous caller mm-hmm. that talked about the loss of her son. Mm-hmm. I, too, have lost my son. And my question, I can identify directly with that caller and what your guest is saying. And I have read Megan Devine's book, It's Okay Not to Be Okay. Mm-hmm. And I ordered your book just now as well. And my question is, how do we educate and teach people as we're building these relationships or trying to make that connection, how to bear witness? That seems to be something that I struggle with, but I also know it's difficult. It's difficult for the person who's building that relationship with, as it is for the person who you really want to express on how to bear witness. Bear witness.
So that's a really interesting phrase, bear witness. And I think we were talking about listening earlier, but I sense that you mean something very different by that. And so, Barbara, before I go back to Anna, I want to give you a chance to talk about what is it in your mind that is bearing witness? What does that mean?
Well, Stephen, you kind of touched on it. I mean, the listening aspect, mm-hmm. Because when we have these conversations such as death and such as grief, people are trying to fix us. They're trying to give us advice on what we should do in order to get through the next moment. That may not necessarily mean that's what is going to help us. Mm-hmm. I often find that in building these relationships and developing this deep trust, that it takes a while. So, you know, having the space for people to be able to talk about it without the other person that you're talking about it with constantly interrupt you, walk away, don't answer the phone, and many other things that come along with it. Hopefully,
I'm absolutely understanding what you're saying and where you're coming from. Anna Sale, I wonder what your reaction is.
Yeah, Barbara, thanks for saying that. When I hear you say bear witness, I think of it as like not just listening, but also having the sort of fortitude to hold what you are hearing. Mm. And I think that your question, how do we sort of teach that in our relationships? I think one huge way is modeling it in how you interact, you know? So if somebody is telling you something difficult, like if being that friend who just listens and says, oh, and like lets it have a beat of just being absorbed, you know, that can feel profound when you are the person being listened to. And also they're seeing, oh, look at how Barbara handled that. That felt, maybe in my next conversation where somebody is telling me something heavy, I might try that. The other thing that you made me think about was, you know, I've had the privilege of coming at hard conversations as a journalist and not as a, you know, I'm not a therapist or a psychologist, you know, no, people don't come to me with the expectation that I will fix things. What motivates my work has always been, I want to understand more clearly what you are going through. And so that's sort of where this book came from, which was, you know, when I have had journalistic conversations of saying, oh, you said bearing witness and not listening. Like, what did you mean by that? And hearing somebody answer that, then I understand more clearly where they're coming from. And I've learned that from doing that as a journalist, when I do that in my relationships, when I lead with trying to see the people I love more clearly instead of fixing them or comforting them, it's a deeper interaction.
Yeah. Yeah. Barbara, again, really appreciate the call and sorry, deeply sorry for you losing your son as Adrian did. Boy, that's it's one of the toughest things I think anyone can manage. Let's go next to Dr. Longs, who's calling from the Wayne County Juvenile Detention Facility. Is that right, Dr. Longs?
Hi, yes. Hi. I've called in before, but I've never been able to call in as I'm sitting in my office. But yes, I'm the mental health director at the Wayne County Juvenile Detention Facility, which is sort of annex to the Wayne County Jail.
Right.
But, you know, as I've listened to the other callers, particularly the moms who've lost sons, it's kind of pretty much what I see every day here. And so I want to ask your guests, in dealing with grief and bereavement, you know, how you approach that with adolescents, you know. And there was about 2 years ago, there was a case in Warren where I kind of got involved in, and I remember writing, you know, based on the tragedy of the case, you know, sort of how do you approach parents, survivors of trauma, when in essence it seems like their adolescence has been foreclosed on.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm preparing my day today, and I look at my kids I'm going to try to see today, and it is kids who are dealing with trauma. But some of these kids dealing with trauma are actually the perpetrators. So, you know, having a discussion with them with the idea that these are still young people, you know, searching for their own identity, you know, being diffused into different things like gangs, et cetera. And some of the other concepts that were that came up, how they hold on, you know, when I say foreclosure, because they view it as everything's being about money and pride and, you know, dealing with beefs and all those sort of things. And, you know, revenge is what they think the solution is. So,
Dr. Longs, I really appreciate this call and that perspective. That is an incredible observation that you just made. Anna Sale, I want to give you a chance to respond.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for your work, and I think you are the expert in your work. But the one thing that I think about, whether it's adolescents or whether adults, you know, being that person where the guard can come down and the feeling can just be expressed that's underlying the pain is that's the gift. Mm-hmm. It's not, you can't control when those moments happen. You can't control when that person you're walking into the room to speak with is going to be ready to just feel the feeling. But you can create the opportunity. And maybe sometimes that's sort of saying, you know, I might have this wrong, but is this something you're feeling? Or, you know, saying, you know, kind of to just like creating these little openings. You know, I can remember when I was 14 and I didn't go through what you went through, but this was something I can remember struggling with. Is that something that sounds familiar? You know, that those little openings where somebody can say, yeah, and just have that exchange and feel less alone in that moment.
Yeah. And the question about how we talk about these things with young people. I mean, he's talking with them with young people who are incarcerated, but I think all young people are struggling right now with some of these same issues that we have as adults, and it looks different when their minds are adolescent minds.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways that adolescent minds are different than adult minds, but one way in particular that I think about is, you know, they've had less time to accrue the language to even understand what the flood of feeling is. It's just a feeling, you know. And so what I remember as a teenager kind of like grasping for whenever I found a word that somebody used to explain some feeling that felt resonant with me, it felt like a revelation. Because otherwise it felt like inside my head it was this very foreign, very isolated experience that was only happening to me.
Yeah. Okay, Anna Sale, it was really fantastic to have you here with us for this conversation, and congratulations on the book. It really is a wonderful and insightful read. Thanks so much for being with us on Detroit Today.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thank you to your wonderful callers for sharing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that is going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy and Kim Trent are going to join me to talk about their work to clear Detroit's massive rape kit backlog, which recently won them an award from the Museum of the Courageous. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.